Tanya takes on Kelly. The Reserve Bank predicts a painful 2021 and the Bernie meme that's changing lives. This is The Week on Wednesday. Hello and welcome to The Week on Wednesday. I am your host, Ben Davison, and with me, as always, is my glamorous co-host, freshly back from sunny, sunny New South Wales.
It was sunny, actually. It was beautiful.
Van Badham, how are you, Van?
I always feel like a traitor when I go to Sydney,
well,
by the
are.
Way.
It is a treacherous thing
The town I was born in, and if I ever have a good time there, I feel like I'm letting down all of Victoria.
Does anyone ever really have a good time in Sydney? I'm just putting so many of our listeners offside.
Ben is originally from Ballarat and is so parochial, he gets angsty if we even say the word Bendigo in the house.
I just don't think it's a real place. I think
Bendigo is a beautiful town and I'd like to spend more time there. What are you even like?
Anyway, people should come and visit Ballarat. It's a lovely town. Home of the Eureka Stockade, Sovereign Hill, Crowell Castle, however you like your history, whether you like it medieval or 19th century, we've got both.
Yes, that authentic Ballarat medievalism. And let's not even unpack the colonial assumptions of that.
Yes,
not today, not today.
No, today we want to talk about Tanya Plibersek confronting Craig Kelly.
On behalf of the nation, thank you, Tanya.
Stepping in and doing what the Prime Minister and leader of the Liberal Party refused to do, and that is to hold him to some form of account. If people haven't seen the photo of Tanya looking
laughing in his face, that's my favourite one.
Oh, no, I like the one where she's looking at the camera while he is ranting. I think Bill Shorten tweeted it. It's hilarious. People are memeing it already. It's, you know, when your crazy uncle goes off tap at Christmas, the face we all wish we could pull.
Oh, the best one I saw was of Craig Kelly looking just like an absolute, you know, explosion in a bakery, and he was, somebody had tweeted, I'm not too sure about this Caddyshack reboot. And he's gone full Rodney Dangerfield. And to paraphrase a film that probably shouldn't be quoted directly, never go the full Rodney Dangerfield. It was truly hilarious. So what happened was Tanya Plibersek, obviously prominent Labor identity. And
from Sydney.
From Sydney. Many good things, like your partner in life from Sydney. Anyway, Tanya apparently had been doing an interview with Sky News in the morning, probably for practice. Nobody watches Sky News. And she was in the, because all the media studios are in the same place, and she encountered Craig Kelly in the hallway. He was off to do an interview with Channel 9. And Tanya went him and was just like, how dare you spread all this misinformation about coronavirus and about treatments for coronavirus?
Good on her,
are you doing? She is speaking on behalf of the nation because, as you and I both know, Craig Kelly is one of those backbench MPs, you know, safe Liberal seat or nominally safe Liberal seat, who was protected by Scott Morrison. There was an attempt to roll him in his seat before the last election, and Scott Morrison doused it and protected this guy.
The local members wanted a different Liberal candidate.
The local Liberal members wanted a different Liberal.
Yeah.
Scott Morrison intervened in order to protect him, presumably because Craig Kelly is one of the numbers within the Liberal caucus that keeps Scott Morrison in place, God help us. Mm. And since then, of course, Craig Kelly, who's your textbook, I get outraged by art, lefties under the beds kind of conservative nut job, basically, has built this enormous online presence by just playing to the peanut gallery of conspiracy theorists, cranks and weirdos. And he's going for that sort of sub-Trump level of internet loon is really who his people are. So he pushes climate change conspiracy theories. Oh, is this his most recent post, last time I checked today, was, is global cooling happening? And, you know, like it's this sort of, you know, I generally consider the work of Andrew Bolt, where commentary goes to die, and Craig Kelly, in terms of his political insight, is sort of digging a hole underneath the graves where the bodies created by Andrew Bolt's commentary are buried. And it's lunatic kind of stuff. And it is playing to that sort of.
And he's built a huge following.
It's huge. Now, the thing to remember,
because he's one of the most followed Australian politicians online.
Yeah, he's got one of the biggest followings of any Australian politician online. The thing to remember before everybody starts to panic, yes, there are lots of cranks and weirdos in Australia. There's, you know, there's a proportion of them as there are everywhere else in the world. But he also attracts an international following because, you know, crank and weirdoism is international.
Yeah.
So he does get Americans and that sort of conspiracy community all over the world. I mean, you can find them anywhere and they participate, you know, in these international
And he shares a lot of these American conspiracy theories.
And he shares the American stuff, and he's an important source of distribution. So is George Christensen, of course, who's the member for Mackay. And it's a real concern because he's been pushing out coronavirus misinformation.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, Labor have been attacking the Prime Minister for the past few weeks, going, we are living in this ongoing health emergency. We don't have the vaccine in Australia yet. We can't, all of the, you know, the one job that Scott Morrison volunteered to do when it came to coronavirus, everything else gets outsourced to the states apart from the vaccine so Scott Morrison can make himself look like a hero. And of course, there's a delay and there's another delay and it's, you know, disastrous. And, I mean, if we weren't an island, let's face it, we would be in real trouble.
Oh, we could be in real trouble, absolutely.
And so we're still in the middle of it. And there's Craig Kelly, who seems to not know that the American election has been and gone and Trump was trounced, talking about our old favourite hydroxychloroquine, which is this – it is just completely round the bend and pushing this whole, oh, why don't doctors want you to take hydroxychloroquine and we should be prescribing this and, you know. Mm. And it's like Donald Trump, who is responsible – there are media studies that say hydroxychloroquine would not be a thing – if Trump hadn't seized on it.
Yeah.
So there was some, like, cranky weirdo French doctor, I look this up online and you'll know exactly what I mean, from the interviews, who was pushing hydroxychloroquine and blah, blah, blah. And, of course, coronavirus, everybody wants to solve the coronavirus problem.
Yeah.
Like, economies aren't functioning. You know, cities are collapsing. There's another outbreak in Brazil this week that is absolutely flattening one of its cities where they'd already had a 75% infection rate. They thought they developed. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And this is back last year.
Yeah.
And this city, a city of 2 million people, thought that they had a herd immunity just because so many people had coronavirus. Well, there's a new variant in Brazil because Bolsonaro is the president there and is completely incompetent.
Trump of South America.
And is the Trump of South America. Brazil has had the second highest number of deaths in the world now from coronavirus because they've got, you know, the B-grade Trump. I mean, that's saying something, isn't it? And a variant has cropped up in Brazil and the city where 75% of people have already had coronavirus, they're all getting coronavirus again and the morgues are full.
So what Craig Kelly has been doing is really spreading this disinformation, using the same kind of Trumpian, Bolsonaro type of rhetoric. He's been going on Sky and doing terrible things as well. I saw he did a podcast with Pete Evans.
Yeah, with Pete Evans. Anti-vaxxer Pete Evans. A 90-minute interview with one of the most reviled people in Australia who has been, Pete Evans has been done for using Nazi iconography in memes and spreading anti-vax conspiracy theories in this absolute.
Was it 40,000-dollar light machine that was supposed to cure you?
Positive vibrations would cure you coronavirus. And engaging in this junk science nonsense. He's an MP. And the reason why I think, you know, why Tanya kicked off and why people have been kicking off a week, Jed Carney got threatened with expulsion from Parliament yesterday.
No, she got gagged.
She got gagged because a former nurse called him a dangerous fool, Craig Kelly. And of course, the Liberal government silenced it. This is their new tactic. They just gag Labor in Parliament all the time. Gag, 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 gag. Even the crossbenchers, everyone apart from Bob Catter, who wasn't there, supported Labor to ask questions about Craig Kelly, and the government just kept silencing it and silencing it. Anyway, so Tanya took her opportunity today in the corridor saying, why are you doing this? Like, do you agree with the Prime Minister or not? Because again and again, Labor have called out, and commentators, myself included, have called out Scott Morrison going, it's a global health emergency. We are not out of the woods yet. The thing happening in Brazil, the variant in London, 1 in 10 people have it in LA. 1 in 10 people have it in London. Like, it is still with us, even though, you know, there's a vaccine. They're worried about these variants may not be resistant to vaccine. If we don't get the vaccine out quickly enough, that the virus will outsmart us and we'll have to go through this whole process again. And you're on the internet pushing out nonsense that's in direct contravention of what the public health guidelines are. And of course, Scott Morrison has defended this as a free speech issue. Well, everybody's entitled to their opinion. It's like he's a member of your government. And what makes me so enraged about this is, as a member of the government, he has no excuse to spread misinformation apart from desperate political cynicism, because he gets all the briefings. He gets the latest, most up-to-date information from the very best experts this country has. The chief health officer has come out and said the stuff that he's pushing on his Facebook page is nonsense. You know, again and again, scientists, doctors, everybody who's actually taking this virus seriously have come out and gone, this is a real problem. Because with the imprimatur of being an MP, it gives this information legitimacy. Yeah, as a member of the government, it gives this information legitimacy.
It's outrageous, isn't it? Because, you know, Morrison has been asked to condemn this. Morrison has been asked to put Craig Kelly back in his box, and he has refused and refused and refused, to the point where Kelly has been essentially free to do this. I think, what did Morrison say?
He said, you know, look up a government health website. Yeah, oh, well, you
don't
should
go
just,
to Craig Kelly.
Don't go to Craig. Don't go to the internet. Just, you know, if you're going on the internet to look for information, you should go to a government health website. And I was like, well, God knows, Australia knows, we can't get reliable support from you.
It's pretty outrageous. I do note that today, after the confrontation with Tanya, Morrison did apparently talk to Craig Kelly, or try and bring Craig Kelly
apparently
into
line. Phoned him yesterday, and they had a chat, and Scott explained that this was just not on because, you know, Craig Kelly, like, he called a mask mandate for children child abuse.
Yeah, see, this
like,
is
that
outrageous.
Is just nonsense. That's like me saying, you know, roads are capitalist imperialism that keep, you know, women in chains. Like, it's this kind of nutty madness. And it's so
embarrassing. Saying a thing simply makes it true.
Yeah, saying a thing makes it true. But I want to get into why this is happening, and because people are like, the hydroxychloroquine and the other sort of treatments that they push, they've been discredited by science.
Yeah.
People want a cure. My God, if there was just a magic pill we could take, we would all take it, wouldn't we?
Of course we would.
And so would every government on earth. Coronavirus is a problem for everyone. But it's important to understand, like, why the far right have latched onto this hydroxychloroquine myth. And it's part of a propaganda model about manipulating people, keeping people in line. Because it's essentially positioning yourself as the truth-telling oppositional. Like, everybody else is in, or, you know, all the other elites are in on this conspiracy to deny you healthcare, and I'm telling the truth, and I'm this brave
person.
I've done my own research.
You should educate yourself.
Do your own research, which is the QAnon line.
You know,
guys, if you want to do your own research, go to university and do a research degree.
That is
the way you do your own research.
Yeah.
And a bit of critical literature analysis. Anyway, so, but it's about, if you can get people to buy into that you are the organ of truth and you are the person with the answer and you are this brave renegade, you know, against this elite conspiracy of smart people who keep, you know, saying complicated things, that means you can basically convince people to do anything. Like, it's about getting people to buy the one lie. Because if you can convince people that doctors are holding out on hydroxychloroquine because they, you know, they're making money from big coronavirus or whatever the latest nutter is, that you can then say, oh, well, back my political party, vote for my candidate, elect Marjorie Taylor Greene, donate to my fund, you know, like, give me money, make donations, blah, blah, blah. It's a grift. This kind of anti-science, anti-reality, fabricated false reality is a grift. And there was a really great essay about why, because Bolsonaro, who got unbelievably sick from coronavirus himself after denying it was ever a problem and let's keep Brazil open. Like, this essay I was reading was asking, like, why do they keep pushing hydroxychloroquine? And it's part of the fabric of a false reality they want you to believe in. Because with individuals who aren't doing anything for coronavirus, pretending that other people are responsible for everything going wrong, and if only they'd listen to my answer. It was what, you know, these guys have been doing, like Trump and why he was pushing it, because there wasn't a coordinated, effective coronavirus response in America. It was all over the shop. Trump found it politically inconvenient. And another study out this week, Trump's own pollsters said that coronavirus is what cost him the election, because people were like,
you're letting us die, Mr. President.
You're letting us die. Where's the answer? And it was like, they just won't prescribe hydroxychloroquine. It's not my fault. fault. You know, it's a get up for people who don't want to take responsibility. And Craig Kelly surfing that attitude, like, and looking for those communities of people is just desperately cynical. Catherine Murphy had a good piece this week where she talked about part of the Craig Kelly thing and the reason why Scott Morrison doesn't want to pull him into line, why they're just having, you know, private chats. And, you know, Craig Kelly is now, after meeting Tanya in the hallway, making a statement that, you know, he's not an anti-vaxxer at all. He's just asking questions. You know, he's just you know, questions. He just wants the best for Australians, whatever. But the reason why the Liberals don't want to pull Kelly into line is because the thing about coronavirus and the pandemic, it's made everybody feel very politically unstable and people are going back to what they know, you know. And so the vote for the major parties is re-coalescing because people want strong, solid leadership and not to take a risk with, you know, the minor parties, the, you know, fringe of political outfits. And, of course, the One Nation voters are coming back to the Liberal Party, and this is in the Liberal Party's interest because One Nation, when you start voting One Nation, your vote gets very unpredictable, where your preferences will go, etc. And the Liberals are very keen to get them back. So these kind of attitudes we'd more associate with One Nationism, the Liberal Party are trying to keep in the broad tent. And I'm like, mate, if you've got people in the broad tent who are pushing quack theories around the treatment of coronavirus, coronavirus will spread and you will have a lot less people in that tent.
Well, you'll have a pest tent is what you'll have.
Oh, you'll have a pestilent tent, a plague tent.
Yeah.
And good on Tanya, I think, because this is the thing, you know, Australians love vaccinations and Australians love coordinated public health responses. And being from Victoria and going, yep, lockdown all over it, we beat it, we fought it back, we got infections down from 800 a day to zero. We're the only place in the world who's been able to turn around something like that. Like, it speaks to a faith that Australians have in science and in leadership and science-based leadership of in politics. And Craig Kelly is just he's literally a plague on all of our houses. I agree with you, Connie. He is a dangerous fool, and 100% congratulations to Tanya for ripping chunks of him today. And I've got to say, the video is hilarious because I was watching it without sound on my travels today, and he's that guy. Like, he's that guy. She's got her arms folded and they're in a hallway and he's sort of positioned her against the wall and he is ranting and he's pointing at her.
Yeah.
At one point, I thought he was going to poke her in the boobs, like, point, point, point. And it's just like, dude, we all know who you are. And if Scott Morrison doesn't have the spine to call you out or is too devious to call you out, Australians will.
But it goes to the weakness of Scott Morrison, right, and his constant failure of timing. You know, so, sure, he's had a quiet word to Craig Kelly. And you're right, there's a political advantage for Scott Morrison and the Liberal Party of having Craig Kelly out there running around, just like there's a political advantage for him to have Andrew Bragg and James Patterson out there running around undermining superannuation.
Just doing, like, their crazy IPA routine. I mean, there are so many crazies in the Liberal Party,
like,
to pick from.
Just like Tony Abbott doing his crazy IPA routine. Just like when he initially said, oh, don't worry, there's not going to be a need for a wage subsidy. Everyone will just be able to get Centrelink. Next day, a million Australians unemployed, queues around the corner down the street. Oh, maybe we'll have a wage subsidy. You know, this is a guy who will push and push and push for the maximum political advantage. And it's only when it turns the other way that he'll actually do anything. He has no ethical position whatsoever. Somebody I saw wrote something online saying, you know, this is what you get with a right-wing government. And somebody responded, it's not a right-wing government, it's just an opportunistic government. And this, I think, is the reality of Scott Morrison.
Oh, he loves being the leader, not so hot on the actual leading.
And frankly, it's interesting to start to see the rumblings even within the Liberal Party about what are we here for? What are we doing? You know, this is a third term. It was reported this week, you know, Parliament's back. It was reported this week that the Liberal caucus, their get-together, there were some rumblings. You know, we're a third-term government. What are we doing? You know, what have we done to reform industrial relations? What have we done around this superannuation stuff? You know, we've done a little bit on tax, but we should be doing more on tax. You know, all the kind of right-wing ideological positions that so many of that backbench do fervently believe.
But these are the neoliberal ideological positions.
Yeah, that's
not
right.
Not your crazy weirdo ideological
positions. No, not the crazy weirdo ones. But
although they're always happy to tag along with the neoliberals, have you noticed?
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's the road to power for them. So, but this is the point. You know, Morrison apparently tried to downplay that, even with the pushback that he's getting on the IR stuff from the union movement. Those campaigns have been launched. You know, he's starting to say, oh, well, we'll have to just see, and obviously there'll be changes and all the rest of it. He is desperate to hold power. And whether it's placating crazy far-right Americanized conspiracy theorists with Craig Kelly, or actually a preparedness to kind of abandon the neoliberal platform in bits and pieces and only pick it up when he thinks he can get away with it, he'll do whatever it takes.
You know, it's interesting because they are a third-term government.
Yeah.
And by the third term of Howard, which, you know, I had the painful experience of living through as an adult, you knew what that government was building, you know? It was building this sort of selfish, individualistic, entirely, you know, those who can get wealth should get wealth and those who can't can just, you know,
be left by
suffer and die. But you knew, like, that was that Howard was building a thing. He was taking apart the post-World War II welfare state, whatever remained of it. You know, he was pushing beyond the expectation.
Freezing super, driving down wages,
just, you know, taking a boot at Medicare and the rest of it. But you look at these Liberals, and I mean, they've done some terrible things.
Well, they have frozen wages for 7 years.
They have frozen wages. They've deliberately engaged in wage suppression. They've turned a blind eye to exploitation of people by banks and financial services, and they've driven greater wealth inequality than this country has ever known. But beyond that, what's the legacy? Like, what's the legacy? What have they built? You know, what ideas have they shared with the populace?
Like, Howard had the GST, at least.
You know, and
that was something that he really believed in.
You know, and I will always credit John Howard, it's hard for me to say those words, for the gun ban. Like, that's one of Australia's proudest legacies, is that we did something about gun control.
Yeah.
You know, and wouldn't every American who's had to grieve somebody killed in gun violence envy the decision that we made as a country, that Howard took responsibility in the wake of Port Arthur and did. But excuse me, what has Morrison done, or Turnbull, or Abbott, God help us, apart from make us feel a bit like cringy, embarrassed and lagging behind?
Yeah.
You know, and this is, and part of the Craig Kelly thing for me is like, I'm going to write about it for The Guardian this week, about windows and about windows for opportunity for nation building and legacy and those kind of things. And the fact that you've seen Biden come in the United States and go, right, Trumpism, it's gone. It's over. It's executive order after executive order. These appointments, they're appointing all these people to boards. The new defense secretary came in and purged all the Trumpists from all the defense policy committees today. Like, there's this new moment. They're taking action. They're building this new policy reality which will affect everybody, and yet Craig Kelly is tweeting Trumpist nonsense that's been out of date since November, mate.
Yeah.
Like, Trumpism is over. You know,
it's interesting, isn't
they're moving on. You know, this is on a tangent, but there's an article I want everybody to find that really caused me a brain bleed yesterday, which was about how a significant number of people who participated in the Capitol riots to stop the stealing of the election did not even vote.
Did not even vote. Well, one of the other things I wanted to talk about today is obviously the Reserve Bank. It's a little less sexy, but...
Ben, can I just say, whenever you talk about the Reserve Bank, I personally find it very sexy.
Oh, that's good news. I hope others do too, because it is actually really important, because there are two major levers that exist in the economy that can be determined by policy and kind of almost have instantaneous effects, whatever they might be, right? One is fiscal policy, which is government doing things, government saying we're going to do this, putting money into it, stimulating the economy. The other is the Reserve Bank through monetary policy, through cutting interest rates, through printing money, through using money, if you like.
And what do they call printing money, Ben?
Quantitative easing.
Yeah, so it's not really printing money if you call it quantitative easing.
Anyway, so the Reserve Bank met yesterday, have kept interest rates at record lows, and Governor Lowe, who's the head of the Reserve Bank, gave a speech today at the National Press Club. And really some of the key things that have come out of that go to the deficiencies with the Morrison government, right? Because the Morrison government is starting to wind back some of the financial side, some of the supports for the economy. JobKeeper, JobSeeker, those things are going to be cut. Even the Home Builder program comes off in March. There's a whole series of spending things that will dry up, and Morrison in his press club, our dog's chasing away the neighbour, Morrison in his press club speech yesterday talked about how, oh, money's not free and we're going to have to tighten our belts. So, of course, you've got the Reserve Bank going, well, we're still miles away from full employment, miles away from the inflation target of 2 to 3%. We have no wage growth, so we're going to have to keep interest rates low. There are all sorts of things that Governor Lowe has talked about that are worth looking at. The first and probably the most important is around employment, right? So all the talk of, well, you know, the economy is recovering and employment's recovering. Unemployment is still looking at 6% plus, right? 6% plus. That's well higher than it was pre-pandemic.
But it's not just unemployment that's the issue, it's underemployment.
Well, that's right. So at the moment, you're looking at about 2 million Australians unemployed or underemployed. Now, when you consider that having an hour of paid employment is employment, then underemployment can mean that you might be anywhere from, you know, 50 or 60 bucks a week below what you want to earn, right through to really only earning 50 or 60 bucks a week and the rest of it just isn't available for you. That's a huge problem. That's a huge problem of underutilization of people, of potential that's gone to waste, of economic opportunity that's denied to people and their families. It's also a problem because it means there's so much slack in the labour market that it's hard to have the kind of natural, inverted commas, growth in wages that the Reserve Bank relies on. It's a neoliberal institution. It uses neoliberal frameworks. When unemployment goes down, wages will come up. That's always what they say. He said it again today. He said it again yesterday. Right? And of course...
But it's not true.
And of course, we know that. We know that it's not true.
It's not true, Ben.
We know that there are other elements, right? We know that power is an element. We know the replaceability is an element. So access to more exploitable temporary migrant workers is an element. We know that there are all sorts of other factors that come into play when it comes to wages. If you can't bargain, it doesn't matter if everybody's in a job, you're still not going to get paid, right? Like, it's an extreme example, but I use it to highlight how false the narrative of full employment will automatically lead to full wages. Every slave had a job. There were still no wages, right? Like, it's not a natural state of being that having a job and everybody having a job means wages will always go up.
No, because it relies on policy, like on policy settings. You know, they talk about the origins of the trade union movement in the West came in the wake of the Black Plague. Mm. So after the Black Death Plague in Western Europe, it was the first time when there was like a massive contraction in the pool of available labour. So you had farm workers who were like in indentured servitude, who was suddenly the most precious commodity in the British Isles because so many of them had died and you couldn't tend your fields without them. So they started engaging in wage negotiation. They started moving... Mm. Well, I'm going to leave you, Sir Bottomsley, and go off to work for Sir, you know, Aristo, and would put in wage demands. And of course, this became, became a big rebellion because, you know, everybody...
The Peasants' Revolt, I believe they call it.
The Peasants' Revolt, you know, Wat Tyler and the rest of it. And where a woman, in fact, cut off the head of the Chancellor because it all got a bit rowdy. But what happened was the aristocracy came in. And so, yeah, wages were being negotiated and these things were happening. The aristocracy came in and brutally and violently suppressed the peasants and killed lots of people, even though, you know, their productivity was so important. And the rest of it. That's a political decision. It's a really good way of understanding that it's the policy settings, like what you allow.
That's right.
Are you going to allow these people to negotiate around a fair price for the labour, or are you going to round them up and commit mass executions? I mean, that's a policy choice.
And an entirely modern example is the article that came out over the weekend of the farmer who told the story of finding workers by putting up wage rates.
Amazing.
Normally he relied
local
on backpackers.
Yeah. Yeah, usually he relied on local backpackers, but he put up wages. Didn't all these locals applied for the job?
So
amazing.
So this is the sort of crazy reality we're in, and Governor Lowe has made the point that wages will remain very, very low. Wage growth will remain probably below 2%. He's saying that until unemployment gets down, you know, to 4-5% at least, you're going to have no wage growth. So the inflation target's not going to happen. But of course, we're seeing asset prices go up. House prices are still going up. Wages are now going to stay at record lows. Interest rates will remain very low. That will fuel asset prices. So not just housing, but also the stock market. Money will remain cheap. Of course, you've still got to be able to borrow it. You've still got to have access to investments that you can put it into. And most people, the reality is most people don't. It really, for most people, if you gave them $10,000, what's that going to do to their long-term wealth? Well, probably not a lot, because what are they going to do with that money? They might put it on their mortgage. Great. They might put it in a managed fund. Probably not. They're more likely to put it in the bank. They're more likely to pay off their bills, that sort of stuff. So cheap money is not necessarily the answer if your wages aren't going up and you've got no job. In fact, it doesn't really help you at all. What it will do is it will help rich people get access to more money to make more money. Now,
driving a further division in the economy, quite simply between the haves and the have-nots.
Absolutely.
And, I mean, and this is the thing, we know, I mean, the Liberal government admitted they'd been engaging in wage suppression.
Yeah, absolutely.
That is their policy.
That is their policy.
And, you know, if you live off investments or you own the company, great.
Yeah.
You know, there are tax benefits for you. There are all of these, like, government grants for you. And, of course, you know, another aside is that if you thought sports rorts was the end of it, you haven't seen anything yet. Michael Pascoe was talking this week about how all this money that's been spent on community development grants entirely targeted towards Liberal seats, of course. So this kind of largesse that the Liberals are willing to dispense to their base and their backers and a certain class of person, but a working person, God help you if you're a working person in the unstable economy, there's nothing for you from these people.
And the great fallacy here is that you've got Frydenberg coming out saying there's $200 billion in savings that have been put away since the start of the pandemic, right? But that's not working people, right? That's businesses, usually not small businesses either, by the way, but that's businesses, that's people on upper middle class and above incomes. And there's not a lot of scope for monetary policy, for the Reserve Bank, for Lowe to help people at the lower end.
And he said this today.
Yeah, and
like they had no power to put wages up at the Reserve Bank.
No power to put wages up.
They can't compel the government to do anything. He said that in the press club today.
And the other thing that he said that I thought was really interesting is that he supports an increase in job seeker payments, right? And that's unusual. It's unusual for the Reserve Bank governor to make a statement about government policy, which job seeker payments are.
Particularly around welfare.
Yeah. Clearly, this is a man who is frustrated. This is a man who can see that, yes, there is $200 billion, and it's sitting in the accounts of people who, if they went out and spent it and created jobs, great, but they're not doing that. They're not going to do that. And that puts pressure on him to put up interest rates, which, of course, if he was to do that, impacts that middle and lower end of the housing market. So that's people who have a mortgage but are struggling already, suddenly then have to make bigger payments. So, but the higher interest rates does tend to encourage people to invest their money rather than hold on to it, right?
Well, this is the big mythology of neoliberal capitalism, is that the trickle-down theory is based in the idea is if you give all the money to the rich people, they'll create all these opportunities for everybody else because they'll invest in businesses and they'll innovate and they'll invent things and it'll be just like the Industrial Revolution all over again, except that doesn't happen anymore.
No.
They don't go, well, I'm going to go out and build an even better steam engine, Jones. Like, that's not what they do. You know, they park their money. They can park their money all over the world. They can park it in the Bahamas, in Panama or whatever, and, you know, and just live off wealth or do what they do in Russia and buy themselves dashes and
billion-dollar castles.
You know, so like it's
a huge challenge. And frankly, all the kind of speculation at the end of last week was, oh, interest rates will go up and the economy is recovering so much quicker. And sure, the economy didn't entirely disintegrate, which was the big fear. So that's good. didn't entirely disintegrate, but for the 2 million Australians who are unemployed or underemployed, there are some very, very challenging times ahead. We will see, and Lowe said this, that when JobKeeper and JobSeeker end, there will be more people who suddenly find themselves unemployed, who have less hours, who have less money.
Because there'll be less money pumped in the economy. I mean, we've talked about this before. We've seen the downturn in small businesses locally since JobKeeper and started to take a hit. Mm. We know that JobKeeper going has meant that people haven't got the disposable income to participate in the economy around us. And that's having an effect on those businesses.
And there are so many indicators here, right? Like, you know, we could be, you could make things up until the cows come home. And frankly, Josh Frydenberg and Scott Morrison do. But there are real tangible indicators that people like the Reserve Bank or organisations like the Reserve Bank look to. So you've seen an increase in payday loans since JobKeeper and JobSeeker were cut in towards the end of last year. So in October, November, December, you saw increases in the number of people taking up payday loans. You saw increases in people defaulting on loans as well. Sure, the banks have been easy on people's mortgages, but there are other credit lines out there, whether it's a credit card, whether it's a payday loan, whether it's some other form of credit, and defaults are up. You start to see reductions in grocery spending. We've talked about that before on the show. You start to see reductions in business investment in equipment, particularly from small business. That usually means they're expecting a downturn in demand. So all of these indicators are there. They're most of this data is publicly available. You start to see increases in disability claims, in temporary protection income support claims from insurance providers. All these things show that people are really struggling, the economy is not going to hit top gear, and in fact, any reduction in financial support from the government is just going to take away the legs of even more people than they already have. The Reserve Bank is doing everything it can. It's literally printing another $100 billion in Australian dollar currency to try and make more money available in the system. But unless the government takes that money itself and puts it into programs, all that it is going to mean is that asset prices, investment properties and stocks are going to go up in price. And that generally does not help everyday Australians. Just doesn't help them.
No, it doesn't. It is really frightening, like the idea of there being this two-speed economy, like, because I'm 46, right? And I was born in the 1970s at a time where I think people had a lot of optimism that we were leaving that kind of have and have-nots past behind, that we had this post-World War II economy and we'd had full employment in Australia and, you know, we had opportunities for people and the idea that my parents never got the opportunity to go to university, but I would, you know, these big social
institutions.
That things
would keep getting better.
And all of a sudden, you know, well, it's not all of a sudden, it's 40 years of neoliberal policy. Absolutely, it's pulling the ladder up behind everybody else, you know, and it's a hard thing to confront that we're staring at exactly the same set of problems that led the West to the worst period of its history in the 30s and 40s. Like,
and I think a lot of people had hope that the silver lining of the pandemic cloud would be a rethink of those economic inequality policies, you know, and you saw in England people say, well, austerity has to be over now. But already they're talking about it coming back. Obviously, Morrison's speech yesterday highlights that we're going to have to spend $2 billion on vaccines and money's not free. It's like, mate, $2 billion in the context of the Australian economy is nothing, particularly when you consider the cost of not doing it. But that rhetoric is re-entering the vernacular really quickly. And that's about setting up a them and us, a haves and have-nots, a here's the line, and if you're not above it, then you're below it. And if you're below it, you're on your own. And if you're above it, then you're a success. All these sorts of rhetorical, political arrangements that really do foster a set of economic inequality policies that as you say, created that real horror show of the 30s and 40s. And we don't want to go back there. And there are some positives. Like what Biden's doing in the US is fantastic. There's going to be lots of pressure in the rest of the world. As a result of some of that, you see some of the European economies, even Canada, you know, still bucking against some of these trends.
I realise this is ahead of the good news, but there's a massive campaign to unionise Amazon taking place at the moment.
Fantastic.
And, you know, Biden is a union man. Like he said before the election to business, I want you to be aware of the fact that I am a union man and I will be absolutely pushing an expansion of labour union rights in the United States. Like he gave that speech. And in Alabama, where a huge Amazon outfit is, it's being led by a workforce basically of black women who are like, enough's enough. This is the worst statistic of the week.
Well, can I just say,
20,000 Amazon employees caught coronavirus. 20,000.
See, and, you know, some more good news is that in Australia, unionism is growing as well, right? So while non-unionised workplaces are getting coronavirus, and we saw that in Australia. We saw privatised aged care where there are lower rates of unionisation, less emphasis on safety, more emphasis on profit, less staff available, less PPE. You had higher rates of coronavirus in highly unionised government aged care. You had lower rates, right? Like we know that. So in Amazon, it's not surprising. Where Alabama is not a particularly union-friendly state to begin with. They have a different system over there. And Amazon is an anti-union employer, particularly in the United States. Not surprising. But what's positive, as you say, is Biden is going to push to have more unionization in America and in Australia. From my understanding, we're actually seeing unions getting more and more members. And that dichotomy is real. It's not about having a two-speed labour force. It's not about having, you know, people at the bottom of the labour force. It's about how you lift everybody up. And that's the good thing about union values, right, is it's about how we lift everybody up and show solidarity so that everybody has a better, safer working environment and they're getting paid properly.
And frankly, if employers can bank $200 billion, I think they can afford to meet some pay claims.
Absolutely. Now, Van, tell us the good news and we'll wrap up for the week.
All right. So, Bernie Sanders.
Yes.
You like him?
Oh, look, he's got his moments. He's had his moments.
Yeah, yeah. I like him.
Yeah.
And everybody liked the meme of Bernie Sanders at the inauguration wearing his little mask and his mittens.
Yeah, Bernie Sanders memes are great, right? Like, once again, I'm asking you to join your union. Once again, I'm asking you to protest in the street. You know, that one's a good one.
Yeah, but the picture of him with the mittens, everybody saw it because it was everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
My personal favourite was when they subbed him into the meeting between Darth Vader and the Emperor. In I think it's Return of the Jedi, and he walks past all the troops.
Oh yeah,
and all the troops of Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was everywhere. He was on Mars, and so it was a huge thing. Well, Bernie Sanders is a politician with a sense of humour.
Yep. Likes to lean into these things.
He loves to lean into these things. And he was like, well, this meme exists, so why don't we do some, if you like the meme, you can buy a T-shirt with this picture of me and my mittens on it, or a bunch of other merchandise all through my site, and the money will go to Meals on Wheels. Other people heard about this and were like, a woman, I think in Texas, knitted a Bernie Sanders, she crocheted, rather, a Bernie Sanders. I don't want to get that wrong. Don't want to kick that fight. She crocheted a Bernie Sanders in his mittens like a doll and auctioned it on eBay starting price 99 cents and said, however much I can make, I'm giving it to Meals on Wheels. Well, the crocheted Bernie Sanders went for $20,000.
Wow. Somebody really likes crochet or really likes Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, and the Bernie T-shirts and things on his website, $1.8 million.
Wow.
All going to Meals on Wheels and supporting those kind of social charities, which is amazing. And the woman who made the mittens, who's apparently like, she's also from Vermont, which is the state that Bernie Sanders is from, and she, you know, recycles clothes. It was made of recycled sweaters or something.
Yeah.
She got so many demands for new mittens. she couldn't possibly keep up. Like, she wouldn't be able to make that many mittens in her lifetime. So she's partnering with a bunch of social enterprises to bring out sort of Bernie Mitten stuff.
That's fantastic.
And creating jobs and opportunities for people in recycling, low waste, low environmental impact textile manufacturing. And I'm just like, I love that story. That's a really happy story.
That is a really happy story. And it's a great way to end the week. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been The Week on Wednesday.
I'm Van Batten, and I've calmed down from my earlier tantrum about Craig Kelly, which I hope you enjoyed.
Thank you so much for listening to us. Don't forget to share this on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. If you want to do a TikTok about The Week on Wednesday, go for it.
Because we can't do that because I'm too old.
Do remember to talk about these issues with your friends, your family, your colleagues and your co-workers. Do join your union. Do get actively involved in your community. It is really important. We really appreciate everybody who's been listening, who's been engaging with us on social media, who's been sending us emails.
It's just so great when we get comments and people want to engage further with some of the articles and things we talk about. It was awesome when we talked about food poverty in the UK. I got all these requests for people who wanted to follow Jack Munro, who's the chef and anti-poverty campaigner, and hopefully helped Jack sell some books, which is great.
Yep.
And we love it. We love thinking that we're actually not just two people in a shed with a microphone, but part of a community of progressive left-wing people who want to make a material change to the world.
And don't forget that I do the weekend wrap on a Sunday afternoon.
I love the weekend wrap. That's where I get all my news from, Ben on a Sunday.
So don't forget to tune into that.
Our dog has just returned to the shed. Hello, Germanicus. You are very cute.
Thanks for joining us. Love you, Vanny.
I love you too.
Bye.
Bye.